Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 98 of Season 5 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is my good friend Alan Sanders from, guess what, The Alan Sanders Show. Welcome back, Alan.
Thank you, sir. Great to be back, and looking forward to diving into today's minute.
If you want to dive too far, just be careful how you dive. You know, just get out of the way. Just get out of the way. So, minute 98 begins with John continuing to clear the way and ends with Lorenzo figuring out what John was trying to explain to him. Physically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yesterday we ended things with John and Marvin, you know, careening through Dulles, trying to get people to move out of the way. Move out of the way, get out of the way, get out of the way. And today we just continue with that, you know, and it starts off with, you know, we have John scream, move, get out of the way, lady, go, go, hey, hey, hey. And then Marvin goes, look out. I mean, it's great just to, you know, it's great that they're throwing in a little bit of comic relief here in the middle of this whole thing, especially when we know what's going to be coming. You know, so it
right.
And what's great is you see, I mean, you talked a little bit about this yesterday, that they keep changing the angle. So you get, you know, a front shot of the go-kart, or you get a back shot, you get a side shot, and all that stuff. But you can like see the crowd like parting in front, and then you see in back the people who are, you know, rejoining the crowd behind him. You know, and just like staring off into the distance, trying to figure out what the hell just happened.
Right. Another well-orchestrated with lots and lots of extras. That whole idea, almost like the golf cart has this bubble around it. And as it approaches, it pushes people apart. And then as it goes by, they come right back together.
That's right. That's right. It's great. I love how they do that. And then
continuity-wise, if you remember yesterday, this whole thing started off first with hearing the somber words of Thornburg through the special broadcast, and then it picks up with them, get out of the way, get out of the way. But they're happening concurrently, and I love how it goes right back to where we were in the broadcast.
Exactly. Goes exactly right back to what he's doing. And now we see Thornburg in the bathroom. Now, did you notice something strange about the phone that he's using? I noticed this when I first saw the movie 33 years ago. You notice anything strange about it?
Yeah, what I noticed is unless it's a cordless, in which case there's no antenna, there's no cord.
No, well, first of all, it's a cordless phone because he's on an airphone. There's no cord.
Okay.
All right. Did you notice that the phone is upside down? He's talking into the earpiece?
I never noticed that before. And maybe I don't know because I didn't do a lot of traveling on airlines with those brand new. I didn't know they were cordless. I thought when you popped them out of the seat in front of you, there was a wire that it connected the phone.
No, they did have some
around the cabin.
They did. They did have those also. I remember having those that were in front of you that had a cord, but they did have cordless ones at the time. Okay. But he's talking into the phone backwards. And maybe later this week or maybe next week, we're going to see that the phone switches and that the, you know, if you look there, the thicker part of the phone is right now by his mouth. Okay.
Right.
So just keep an eye on that.
Piece would be. Yeah.
That's right. Keep an eye on that.
Oh my God. I have seen this movie so many times and I will never not see that.
That's right.
Like, how did the actor, I get when the actor's like, just do what we tell you, you know, you learn your lines, give your performance. How did the actor not realize he had the phone upside down? Like, wouldn't you have felt a difference?
Maybe he did it on purpose. I don't know. That would be my explanation. Because again, later on, we're going to see in a different scene how it's flipped over. So, you know, you'd think that the script supervisor or whoever's in charge of the continuity would have said to him, you got to keep it that way. You know, this is the way you were before. You can't change it.
Rob, we see it in this minute when he goes to put his micro cassette recorder up to the bottom.
I know.
It's not the same bottom.
I okay. know. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that the script supervisor is supposed to make, you know, is supposed to notice these changes.
For some reason, with the way you said it coming up later, I didn't think you meant in a few seconds. I thought you meant like when we come back later in the movie. I didn't really.
No.
Literally
seconds later.
The above shot. Yeah.
I gotta say it. This just reminded me of something on your show. You know, with Blazing Saddles. Okay, when you were talking with Burt Gilliam on your show, and he was talking about the continuity error that you know in the farting scene of Blazing Saddles, mm-hmm. where he doesn't have his hat on his head, but it's around his neck. He needed to keep it there the whole time, and they wouldn't let him change it. So here is right. another example where this person there, the person was doing their job properly. Here, they are not.
Right. I am never, ever going to not unsee that ever again. Well done, sir. I usually pride myself on finding those continuity errors. I'm so attentive to that kind of detail. I point them out. My wife goes, just stop pointing these out. I don't need to know. And I like, look, I'll do this all the time. Like, hey, did you see the hammer was cocked on the gun when he put it in his waistband and now it's not? Did you see that he's got two buttons down on his top shirt of his shirt and now only one? It's like, she goes, why are you paying attention to that? Just watch the movie. Like, because it's a continuity error. I notice it. And I've never, ever until this moment, I am this many years old, when Movie Rob pointed out that Dick Thornburg doesn't know how to use the headset of a phone.
You see. I mean, I've noticed this. I noticed this one of the first times I saw the movie. It's even listed on IMDb. It says Thornburg occasionally talks into the wrong end of the Skyphone in the toilet. So, you see, had you read IMDb, you wouldn't be surprised by this now, would you?
That's true. And now here's the thing. I also know that you have to take it with a grain of salt. I think most of the IMDb stuff is correct, but kind of like Wikipedia, anybody can submit anything, and sometimes it's not 100% right. But obviously, in this case, there's no doubting he's using the phone incorrectly.
That's right. And you can even see partially, like under his thumb, you can see like the symbol on the phone. Mm-hmm. You know, and it looks like it's upside down also.
Oh, yeah, 100%. You can't now not see it when you know what to look for it.
That is correct. And that is why I'm here.
Oh, awesome. That is – thank you. I really love those. It doesn't ruin a movie for me. For me, it just adds a new texture of like, oh, look at – even with multi-million-dollar productions and all of these people and hundreds of behind the scenes, mistakes still happen. People are still people.
That's right. And that's true. And it works really well. So at this point, he continues talking and goes, this is a recording of a conversation between Dulles Tower and the captive aircraft overhead. Right. And you see that he picks up, his mini cassette, getting ready to start playing it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we get like a shot from overhead showing how cramped he is in the lavatory.
While we're pointing out continuity, if you're looking at, and most micro cassette recorders, the cassette is at the very top. The microphone is at the very top. The speaker would be at the bottom. But
that's
he's
correct.
Putting the microphone end of the micro cassette recorder up to the bottom of the phone to transmit. It'd be a lot better if he had the bottom of the micro cassette recorder where the speaker is located versus the top where there is no speaker.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. But it's a good thing he flipped the phone around again. So he's okay
right,
there.
He's at least got the right end of the phone, but now he's got the wrong end of the micro cassette recorder.
That's right. Well, maybe he's holding that upside down.
No, I looked at it. I looked at where the button is. He clicks play with his thumb on the right side, which means it's sitting up. And then he puts that isn't as big of a deal to me. But while we're pointing out errors, if you wanted to have the speaker of the micro cassette playing into the receiver of the phone or the transmitter of the phone, you would have had to turn it up. You would have then had to turn that one upside down.
That's right. You know, so so my first question, and we'll get to this later in the week a little bit, but is he allowed to play this? You know, he recorded this conversation from Barnes. We're not going to hear the conversation right now. Okay. But he recorded it, I guess, illegally. Wouldn't that be like an FAA or some sort of, you know, isn't he breaking some sort of law by recording that conversation that's going over, you know, the airways from the tower to
so you know, the way and every state's going to be a little different, but let's just say this is a state or a municipality that has one party consent. A lot of places like California and others have to have two party consent. Whereas if I'm recording me in a conversation with you and it's about me and you, I'm one party. I can record my conversation and play it and use it in court because it's one party consent. I'm obviously consenting to record myself.
Let me finish.
If it's two person consent, then it would mean you would have to know if we're going to use it in a court of law. You could have whatever I have thrown out. He's obviously not one of the parties. He's eavesdropping on someone else's conversation, but we're not in a court of law. And so, yes, the airport could probably later sue him for having illegally recorded, and it would probably get some kind of a fine. But in terms of news, he doesn't care. Let the station pay the fine. He's going to play what he's intercepted. So, yeah, I think there is an illegality to it because he's not one of the people that was in the conversation. But as a reporter, an investigative journalist, if you will, he doesn't care. It's about the story.
Right. Right. Okay. That I'm aware of. But again, he's broadcasting it to everybody.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, people used to go undercover all the time to get the scoop on the story. A lot of that wouldn't be admissible in court. But when you see it happening, now investigators go dig for the actual records of people doing things. They find the crime that you pointed out through undercover.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And if he's an investigative reporter, I guess that's okay.
Yeah. Again, if he gets fined, if he gets sued, the station would be like, we had everybody that night tuned into our station. More people are now advertising with us. We'll pay your fine. You know, that's how that usually works.
Okay. All right. Interesting. And then the shot changes. We're back with our good friends, Marvin and John, as they're flying through the airport, and they now end up showing up. He like goes into the police station with his a mini cart or whatever you want to call it. So it's just mm-hmm. very, and you see all the like cops scrambling. You know, you see like there's a cop and like a woman that just start running to the other sides as he comes down the hallway. And then there's a guy coming out of a room that jumps backwards. Mm-hmm. And all the other cops just like turn around and everyone's just looking and trying to figure out what the hell's going on. You know, and we hear, mm-hmm. hey, get out of the way. And then John gets off the cart and starts screaming, Lorenzo, Lorenzo. And, you know, he's trying to find Lorenzo and everyone's just staring at him, trying to figure out what's going on. You know, and then Lorenzo runs out of his office and goes, McLean, are you out of your fucking mind? And then John goes, the blue light team, where are they? And then Lorenzo responds and goes, Stewart's got explosives on the equipment in the church rigged with a remote. And he goes, where's Grant? Grant's boys are going to kill that son of a bitch. And then John goes, they're not going to do it. They're going to get on the same goddamn plane and take off with them. Get the fuck out of here. Because when the army canned Stewart, he must have loaded that unit with his own men. Are you nuts? That firefight sideshowed a jerk us off. Buy him some time. McLean, you are completely around the fucking bend. You know that? You know what else? You're under arrest. So, like, what do you think he would be arresting John for at this point? Like, what is John... obstruction of justice? I don't know, telling the truth?
It's one of those almost desperation moves, I guess. I don't know. There's no, I can't think of a crime other than he's trespassing because he doesn't work there. And he's, I don't know. I just think he is just, this guy is sick and tired of this New York cop trying to get in here and trying to show him and tell him what to do.
Right. I mean, I love the way that they have, Lorenzo run out of his office and he's immediately out of breath, mm-hmm. you know, just to show how out of shape he is.
Well, I also think it adds to the frenetic of the scene. We're coming, it's the same carryover, like you mentioned at the beginning. We stage cops diving away from the cart, trying to come out of their office and they're all scrambling. People start yelling and trying to talk. And I think it adds to that cacophony. And so, you can't have Lorenzo kind of saunter out of his office. He's like, but I get what you're saying. Why would he be out of breath? But it adds, I think, to the whole energy of the scene, like the panic of the scene.
Right. Right. And the truth is, you know, Lorenzo wouldn't be as upset if it wasn't. It's, you know, McClane's bothering him in the middle of his dinner. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know.
I mean, the whole energy of this scene, the reason it works is because you and I know everything that's happened up to this point. We've realized something's weird. So the energy's fine. It makes no sense that they start yelling at each other in this scene.
That's but, right. None whatsoever. They just have to raise their voices.
Right. In terms of the movie, it works because McClane is, you know, he's trying to get through to this guy. This other guy hates the fact that McClane's there. So it makes for a good little argument that will end. I'm not going to steal your thunder, but with a moment that I said earlier in the week on Monday, a scene that still to this day shocks me. Like I just didn't see it coming. Yeah. They managed to one up me with this minute.
Right. But what I love here is the way that their conversation goes. They're actually, you know, giving us a lot more of exposition of what's really going on. John has put everything together, and this is the first time it's being verbalized. Correct. You know, that Grant and his men are going to be getting on. Now, we obviously saw, you know, Grant you know, killed Telford. We know what's going on. We know that he's hatchling and that he's going to be, you know, getting together with Stuart. But you know, this is the first time that John has put the pieces together and is explaining it to, you know, to Lorenzo, and at the same time explaining it to us, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love the way they do that. And then I've never heard this before. I never paid attention to the fact that this is what John. Did you know that John like screams, "You motherfucker," and then pushes Lorenzo? You know, according to the subtitles, you don't hear him say it because it's happening so fast. You know, he takes him and pushes him, and as he's pushing him...
You do hear it. It's just, it's said really fast.
That's right. No, but my point is you don't pay attention to it because there's other stuff going on. You're not paying attention to the dialogue. You're paying attention to the action of what's going on here.
Right.
You know, of John pushing him away and then, you know, screaming at him and then pushes him against the wall and then... John just picks up the gun and just starts shooting at him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, there's no reason that John should still be alive after this little action that he does here. You know, none whatsoever.
Oh, no.
I can't think of a single scenario except for the fact that all of these cops are completely incompetent. It's the only explanation.
Well, there's a momentary shot as he's bringing the rifle up. And now, remember, we've had a terrorist incident. We've got a plane crash that's been within the hour. And it seems like every single possible cop is standing now behind John McClane in police headquarters on the airport base, whatever, airport facility. You have a
cop
right to as close as you can get to John McClane with his hand on his holster. He's got his hand on his gun. And not a single person chooses to look at John McClane. They're all looking at Lorenzo.
That's right. And the first, you noticed the one guy with his hand on his gun. As this is going on, I counted 8 cops that draw their guns. Okay? Not a single one of them fires at John.
Nope.
8 cops. I guess they all really hate Lorenzo.
Maybe they're like, well, let him finish the job, then we'll arrest him. I don't know. It is weird because you got the one cop through the window behind Lorenzo, look like he's going to shoot Lorenzo in the butt.
That's right.
And then you got the other
one. Well, because he jumps down. Well, you have one guy jump down and then one guy pull out his gun from there. And, you know, Lorenzo throws his cup of coffee or water or whatever it is that's in his hand. You know, so it's just very strange the way this whole thing happens. Mm-hmm. You know, Sorry, it's not Lorenzo who throws the cup. It's the guy in the room and behind him. The guy in the room behind him, you see him throw a cup. Or is that actually the guy? Is that like a guy in a white shirt running? Oh, no, this is arm. He's holding like a folder in his arm. And it looks like there's an arc going downwards. So it looks like something is being thrown. But it's basically the guy crouching down to get out of the line of fire. From John shooting at him.
Right.
Okay. I didn't try counting how many bullets John shoots, but way too many. And again, he should not be alive. You know,
right. At least one of those cops should have tried to take John out for just engaging with a firearm, hearing the shot. Because it sounds, obviously, they're blanks. But you can't tell the difference. They're still packed with gunpowder for blanks. You're still getting discharge. You're getting the gunfire, the gunpowder residue and the flash off the muzzle.
Right. There's just no projectile. That's the only difference. You know, and theoretically, that is what should be happening. I mean, I don't know if these cops are completely incompetent or they're just very disciplined. Or like I said earlier, maybe they're just waiting to see if Lorenzo's dead. You know,
that seems to be the best explanation. I mean, I remember being stunned in the theater because I was like, wait, he's firing, but I don't see any blood. I'm thinking he's shooting the guy, but there's no blood. But wait a minute. There's no glass break. Wait, it took even me a second in the theater. We're going to get the explanation, but I can't imagine being a cop, though, going, well, hold on. Before we shoot on a guy that's shooting at one of ours, there's no glass breakage. I don't see any blood. And maybe they are all in shock, but it's really weird. It's a very weird scene in especially today's society, to think that you could just open up with a machine gun and get away with it with all those cops.
That's right, for sure. There's no. Now, I mean, I've mentioned this before to other people, and I don't know if I've mentioned it to you. So I figured out the ruse beforehand with the red and blue tape. You know, when I first saw this movie for the first time, because I had read a book and saw a TV movie called The Park Is Mine. I think it was from 1987 with Tommy Lee Jones. The movie was with Tommy Lee Jones. It was an HBO movie that I remember came out, and it was about a Vietnam vet that went and took over Central Park. And the whole part of the ploy is that he isn't shooting real bullets most of the time. He has different clips that are marked red or blue to distinguish between which are the live rounds and which are blanks. So when I saw this movie, I knew that was the thing here. My assumption is, and I obviously can't remember, you know, how I really reacted 33 years ago. My assumption was that I was still shocked that John was shooting at him at this point, because, you know, it comes as a surprise. Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't something that you can prepare yourself for if you've never seen this.
Right. Yeah. It was crazy. They didn't necessarily hide it from you either. This wasn't a red herring, and it wasn't an unsupported part of the story. We saw the color coding. We saw them switching the things around. I just assumed as a moviegoer that there was different ammo for maybe, I don't know, like armor piercing or for cold weather because it was blue versus red. I just assumed it was a different kind of ammo. It never crossed my mind at all that one was for live and one was for blanks.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. So have you ever shot blanks?
Yes, movie sets. I've got a in fact, I had and what's funny is they purposely made it as a 10 millimeter versus a 9 millimeter, so that way when you're buying the 10 millimeter sized ammo, 9 millimeter being a much more standard thing, you wouldn't accidentally load a real live round into the gun. So it fired. Oh, okay,
that's actually quite smart.
Yeah, fired a different side. Now, a lot of times they'll still use regular. In fact, a lot of times they will use live, real weapons, and they'll just get the blanks made for that weapon, so it looks real for whatever movie they're shooting. But in this case, I was using it looked like it was a 45, but it fired 10 millimeter blanks. And it was kind of cool because as a prop weapon, because it was a blank, because it had gunpowder, it caused the hammer to fly back. It caused the shell casing to eject. There was a flash out of the front. That was it. So you could capture it as if you were shooting a real gun. You could have it pointing right at the camera and not do any damage, but you could get all the visuals you needed.
Right. You just need to make sure that it's really a blank.
Right.
So
it's every bit as loud as firing a round. Now, I know sometimes blanks might be not quite as packed, and you've got different kinds of ammo that are going to be packed for a bigger punch. But I mean, it's not like it was a pop gun or something like a cap gun. It sounded like you were firing a real round.
I mean, I don't think I've ever shot a blank because I've never really had to. if I'm gonna,
you know, why would you?
If it was any shooting or no, if you're not on a movie set, or if you're not trying to take over Dulles, I don't think you would have any reason to do that. Okay. Are you familiar with any of the onset accidents that have happened with blanks? And again, we're talking about with blanks, not with real bullets.
Right. No, probably the most famous one was on the set of The Crow, because that was blanks, but someone didn't check the wadding, and it was actually the wadding that got stuck in the chamber. Something got stuck in the barrel, and when the blank went off, because it was such point blank, the wadding is what I think hit the actor and caused his death.
Yes, correct. Okay, so here I'll read to you what happened. So that was with Brandon Lee. Brandon Lee was killed while filming a scene for the 1994 film The Crow by a .44 caliber revolver used as a prop that still contained a bullet from a squib load. A dummy round used during an earlier shoot was hand-loaded by someone other than a firearms expert who removed the propellant powder but unknowingly left a live primer in place, resulting in the bullet being separated from its casing with insufficient energy to exit the barrel. The gun was not properly checked for a retained bullet prior to the incident, and then subsequently fired with a blank cartridge. The blank charge propelled the lodged bullet out of the barrel, fatally injuring Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with any other onset problems?
Well, we just had the one that still apparently has been giving Alec Baldwin some relief when they decided not to press charges. But on the set of Rust, he actually did kill the camera operator.
But that was with a live round. That wasn't with a blank.
Well, it was supposed to be a blank.
Right. No, I'm aware of that. I'm talking about just, you know, that obviously is something, you know, that's completely, you know, completely out of bounds. I'm talking about, you know, an accident that happened with a blank. Okay. No, so
right off the top of my head, those are the two. Well, and if you don't want to count Rust, The Crow is the one that is the one I know off the top of my head. I don't know any other ones.
Right. Okay. So there was a the music video Dopamine was being filmed in 2017 in a bar in Brisbane. So I guess that's Australia, where a professional stunt double named Johan Offner was killed by a shotgun wad that was still in the barrel at the time. Then in 2015, there was a 17-year-old who was playing with a gun that was used in a high school theater program, production of Oklahoma, and he basically shot himself with a blank cartridge thinking that, you know, blanks are harmless.
Mm-hmm.
And then the most famous case, now I remember when this happened, in 1983, I think it happened. Do you remember an actor named John Eric Hexum?
No.
Okay. Did you ever see the TV show Voyagers?
No, never watched that.
Okay. It was a time travel TV show about, you know, I guess you could sort of say a pirate that was plucked out of time, and his job was to go and fix things in time. And okay. he has this teenage kid from 1980 that is helping him, that somehow, you know, like he isn't really able to get to 1980 through time travel, but something goes wrong. And so this kid is trapped with him because he can't bring him back home. And they go through time and correct all these different things that happen. And he was also in the TV show called Cover Up, which was a TV show about models, like a modeling agency who they were like under, who they were also like soldiers for hire and stuff like that. So he was in that. So this actor, John Eric Hexum, accidentally killed himself on the set of Cover Up when he placed a blank loaded .44 Magnum revolver to his right temple and pulled the trigger as a joke. The shockwave from the blank caused a depression fracture to his skull and sent bone fragments deep into his brain. And, you know, he passed away after that. There were claims that they were playing, you know, Russian roulette with it. I mean, it's not really sure exactly what happened, but I mean, these type of accidents, like the one in Rust, are things that shouldn't ever happen.
No, you know, I got to tell you, and obviously you've been in the military, and it doesn't take a military background to know you treat every gun, even a prop gun, as a live, capable of hurting somebody or killing somebody weapon. The blanks, to make them sound and look right, they're going to have a gas release. They're going to have a concussion wave. They're going to have, you don't, it's mind-boggling that these accidents happen, because there should always be somebody on the set, the armorer, who's the person responsible for every scene, every check. In between, you double check, you triple check. Every actor should then double check and triple check. There's no excuse. I've been on way too many sets where I've had to handle firearms, and when the safety's followed, it's super easy. Nobody ever gets hurt. It's when people do dumb things that these accidents happen.
Correct. So again, the dead John McClane, or the supposedly dead John McClane, is still standing there.
And yeah.
And then he starts to explain to Lorenzo what just happened. He goes, here. He pulls out the clip and, you know, points and shows him the bullets there and goes, these are the bullets they used out there tonight. Blanks. Mm-hmm. And I mean, first of all, I always love the fact that in movies, I mean, because I've shot real machine guns, I know how quickly you can empty. You basically will empty the cartridge if you're shooting on full automatic, which you don't usually do. If anything, you're going to shoot on semi-automatic, but that's a separate issue. But John clearly shot far too many bullets for him to be able to pull the cartridge out and show Lorenzo that there are still bullets here, that these are blanks. So
right,
yeah.
Now here's where I will tell you that our actor here for Lorenzo does, I think, the same slow recognition that I felt in the audience. I think he does a really, really good job of processing it. And he doesn't just instantly believe. He doesn't instantly jump to the phone. I love his acting here.
Yeah.
For everything that we just went through. And it's almost like either he did it innately or got the direction from Renny Harlin or both. I think they realize this is a moment the audience needs as well to process what's just happened.
Correct. Yeah. No, Dennis Franz is great. I mean, this is before he became really, really popular and familiar, you know, to all audiences with NYPD Blue. But, you know, he was great here. Mm-hmm. And you're right. You see that he takes his time to let his brain catch up to what's going on. He was just about shot. I'm surprised he didn't have a heart attack. Mm-hmm. We should be happy about that. Or he should be happy about that for, you know. And then when he comes to the realization, he goes, Jesus Christ. And then starts walking over, you know, towards the desk. Mm-hmm. And you can see that he's finally seen the light and finally realizes what's going on.
Yeah.
And I like the way they show that.
Yeah. Every bit about, if you want to just understand how important nonverbal acting is to conveying what's going on, Dennis Franz does a perfect job right here, because he's going through what we, the audience, are going through. And who knows how many takes they had. He remembers to stay out of breath. He still keeps the same disposition. For all intents and purposes, you would have thought this was a one take. And he stays perfectly focused in the moment. He lets it breathe, conveys what's happening in his head, and I love it. I think it's perfectly well spaced and timed to give us a chance to come to the same recognition that he's come to.
That's right, for sure. I think it's done really well. Again, you know, you just have to put aside the fact that it's the ghost of McClane that's talking to him.
Exactly. You know? Yes. In the meantime, we've got a meat wagon on the way to pick up the corpse of the former John McClane, who's been shot multiple times by officers.
That's right. And rightly so. You know, there's absolutely no reason why he should still be alive at this point.
I mean, in reality, none whatsoever. If you wanted to make this point, I mean, I get it for the movie. It's much more dramatic to shove the guy who's yelling in your face and shoot him. John McClane, in reality, if he wanted to make his point, could have just put the gun, pointed to the ground, and just pulled off some rounds and said, see, where's the damage, right? But not as effective for a movie.
That is correct. So I recently just saw there was a limited series called Hijack with Idris Elba. Have you heard of it? It was on Apple.
I never saw it. Never saw it.
It was on Apple. It's great. And there they talk I'm not going to give anything away. It's a great 7-episode show that deals with a hijacking, and there's so many different twists and turns. I was like completely blown away by all the things they did there. But they extensively explain the difference between a blank and a real bullet there, and they do a great job with it.
Excellent. I'll give it. So it's a limited series, so it's just one story and done. It's not like a
ongoing. One story, seven episodes. That's it. Seven episodes. I think of each of them is about 50 minutes, something like that.
That's right up my alley. I get so tired of shows that can't hold it to the end. I don't mind if you're going to tell a. I like the things like Lincoln Lawyer came out season two, but it's like one story told across multiple episodes. If they never do another season of Lincoln Lawyer, I'm satisfied. I don't have stuff hanging in the wings. I don't have stuff I didn't get solved. I love the idea of the limited series. So I'll check it out.
Yes, so do I. So I'm a big fan of what used to be known as the miniseries.
The miniseries, you know, exactly. That's how we grew up.
That now is called a because a miniseries was usually two or three episodes, you know, maybe sometimes a little more. Here it's, you know, a limited series could have 12 episodes, you know.
Well, but in terms of length, although that would be longer, I remember watching like three-part miniseries on TV. It would be from 8 to 11 with commercials.
So that's right.
Still getting two and a half, 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Per night, so it'd be like a 6-7 hour thing. So if you have seven episodes at less than an hour, that's about the same.
Yeah, it's more or less the same. I remember when North and South was all on, and the Thornburgs, you know, all those fun long drawn out miniseries of the 80s.
Oh yeah, hey, let's do a circle around to what we talked about with Pearl Harbor. Herman Wouk's The Winds of War.
That's right. I actually watched The Winds of War. I think about a year or two ago, I watched the whole thing straight through, and I was quite impressed with the way they did it. And unfortunately, I'm not able to. I haven't been able to find copies of War and Remembrance, which I've heard, which from what I understand is even better. You know,
that's the thing I want to go back and check out, because I remember I was disappointed seeing The Winds of War, but I was a middle teenager, and I didn't realize that it was more about the drama and the character and the story. I was wanting like Tora, Tora, Tora. I want to see a lot of action and fighting.
That's right. That's right. Correct. Understandable. All right. So you have anything else for this minute before we get into the script?
Nope. That's going to do it for me.
All right. So the script is once again, you know, very descriptive here. So I'm just going to read through it. We have Thornburg in the airplane laboratory. This is a recording of a conversation between Dulles Tower and the captive aircraft overhead. With a smug smile, Thornburg plays the tape again. In the airport bar, the people listen as the tape of Barnes's earlier broadcast is played. In the airport police office, the golf cart skids to a halt at the receptionist's desk. Lorenzo comes thundering out of his office. McLean, are you out of your f***ing mind? Marvin, this man's been breaking through serious. Give him a break. Lorenzo turns to him. Who the f*** are you? Marvin, pointing at his name tag. Marvin, the janitor. Don't need that custodial engineer crap. McLean grabs Lorenzo. Grant, the terrorist team. Where are they? Lorenzo, they left to shoot those bastards out of the sky. They're not going to do that. They're going to get on the same goddamn plane and leave with him. Before the army canned him, Stewart must have loaded that unit with his own guys. But that firefight at the house, McLean says, a sideshow to jerk us off. Buy them time. You're completely around the f***ing bend, McLean. And you know what else? Reaching for handcuffs. You're under arrest. McLean steps back, raises the assault rifle, and fires. New angle. Lorenzo staggers back in shock and then realizes he's unscathed. What? How? McLean shows him the clip. These are the bullets they use there tonight. Holy So it's more effective in the movie. Mm-hmm. No question about that. And you don't need the extra Marvin comic relief on the side.
No. In fact,
you know, that's just
the
not
last
needed.
Thing you need in this scene. You needed to keep it tense and tight. You built the energy going through the crowd of the airport. You're here now. You get a screaming match. The energy needs to stay serious until the reveal. And I think it was a wise decision either on Rennie Harlan's part to not even shoot it or in terms of choosing to edit it the way they did. I think it seems to me the way that it flows that they just altered the shoot rather than film it as is and then cut it out. And it feels like they just altered the shoot.
That's correct. Okay, so for today's segment, because Alan's already been here, so we've already gone through the segments, you know, the week that he was on months ago. So I decided I'm going to actually give a retro story of Off the Beaten Track, a story that I've already told, but I will tell it again because I told the story back on Plane, Trains, and Automobiles. So anyone who hasn't listened to Plane, Trains, and Automobiles season can now hear the story again. It's a story of, it happened in, I believe it was May 1994. Hopefully the statute of limitations has has expired so that anyone listening to this will not come and arrest me for telling this story of what happened. I had just been released from the Israeli army, and I was getting ready to go back to a trip to visit my family in the States. And before I left to go there, I went and visited some other friends. And during the course of my time in the army, I had lent a magazine clip to a friend of mine. Okay, I know that you're completely in shock about this because in the U.S. Army, you know, you have to sign out every bullet and stuff like that. In the Israeli Army, it's a little different because, you know, you're always walking around with your gun and with bullets, and everyone always has spare clips and spare bullets. Mm-hmm. You know, potentially a hazard, but it also, you know, it's just the way it is. So I had lent through the course, while the time that I was in the Army, to a friend of mine a clip because he was missing a clip or whatever it was. And I happened to see him a few hours before I was flying, and he gave me back the clip. And I took the clip and I put it in my knapsack. Okay. I went home. You know, I'm a very late packer, a last minute packer. So I got back to my apartment. I was going to be listening to my Walkman. Most of it's a 12-hour flight, you know, so I would always pack in a lot of tapes. I just threw a whole bunch of tapes into my knapsack, and I get to the airport. I'm on the plane. I must be halfway between Israel and New York at the time. And I reach into my bag to pull out a tape cassette. And what do I pull out instead? I pull out a full magazine, a full M16 magazine that has 29 5.56 bullets inside of it. And I am ready to crap my pants because here I am on an airplane in over international waters with a live machine gun clip.
Yeah, with multiple. You know,
this isn't blanks like we're talking about. That's right, with 29 live bullets, and you know, didn't know what I was gonna do. And I was like, okay, what do I put it in the seat back? Like the compartment in front of me, either my seat or someone else's seat or whatever. Because my biggest fear at this point was that, okay, I don't know how I got through the X-ray machine because that bag went through the X-ray machine, and whoever was working on the X-rays wasn't apparently paying enough attention. That, because again, I know it sounds really stupid that a person would just happen to have a clip of live ammo in their bag, but you know, had it gone through the machine and they would have stopped me, I would have been able to explain it and, you know, maybe get into a little bit of trouble, but not extreme trouble for the whole thing, because it's not like I had a gun with me at the time or anything like that. But my biggest fear at this point was, okay, I'm going to be showing up in New York and I have to go through customs. And what happens if I get stopped there? Like, what do you do at that point?
Right.
So I basically said, I'm going to take my chances, and I kept it in my knapsack. And as soon as I got to the airport, I, you know, found my bag, my luggage as quickly as possible. And, you know, stealthily tried to make sure that no one would stop me as I'm going through customs. And then I got out of the airport and, you know, I ended up giving the magazine to a friend of mine as a souvenir, you know, that I don't know if he still has 30 years later or not, but, you know, I knew that I couldn't take the risk of trying to get back on the plane with that on the way back home.
Wow.
But yeah, it shows that, you know, this was pre 9/11. I don't know if that means anything because, you know, they do know that the security in the Israeli airport is usually among the best in the world. Mm-hmm. So somehow somebody was sleeping. I mean, I could have gotten someone probably fired if it would have come up or anything like that, you know, someone who wasn't doing their job properly or whatever it was. But, you know, so yeah, that's my story. Hopefully, and I'm going to stick to it, and hopefully there's nobody listening who will come and try and arrest me for smuggling ammunition into America inadvertently. You know, so
I'd like to believe the statute of limitations probably ran its course, but it is a little interesting. I don't know what the rules were at that time. obviously,
I don't think you could walk through with bullets, with a clip of live bullets.
Yeah, I would think you couldn't, but maybe they thought.
But I did.
What is a live, you know, a round of, you know, if you don't have a gun, what are you going to put it in?
Right. That's true. Oh. But again, think about the interrogation that I would have had to go through. Where did you hide the gun?
Right.
You know.
Suck it up your behind, because they'll go look for it.
That's right.
Don't do that.
And this. That's right. And I'll connect this. And you probably didn't hear the story either. Another retro story that is somehow connected to my stupidity when I get on airplanes, or when I got on airplanes when I was younger. I was once flying from Detroit to Chicago. And the same thing, the same type of thing happened, just with a different type of weapon. I was playing with a pair of handcuffs in my house before I got on the flight. And again, somehow the handcuffs landed in my bag. And then when I was at the airport, and this was in Detroit Metro Airport, as I was about to get on, we were going through security, and my bag goes through. And then the woman at the X-ray machine goes, "All right, who's the Joker with the handcuffs?" And I didn't know she was talking to me or anything like that. And she's like, "Tell me whose bag is this and who's." And I look around and I see that it's mine. And I go, "Those are mine." And she goes, "What are you doing with these handcuffs?" And I said, "Oh, I was just playing with them at home, you know. And I guess I put them in the." And she says, "You can't take these on the plane." So I said, "Why can't I take them on the plane? What am I going to handcuff the pilot, you know, or something like that?" And she didn't like that response. Thankfully,
so much.
You know, TSA was very different back then. This was in 1990 when this happened. TSA was a little nicer back then, or was a little more forgiving, I guess you can say. And she said, "Well, if you want to get this to Chicago, you should check it in. You should put it in check luggage." So I went and, one of my friends hadn't finished checking his luggage. I went and put it in there and, I made sure on the way back home that it was in check luggage also. But again, what it goes to show is that, you know, when young Rob is traveling, he doesn't necessarily pay attention to what he's putting in his bag and could definitely cause a lot of incidents.
You know, this is something that happens every year. They do a news story usually at the end of the year. You know, when they're looking for stuff to just fill, or people are going on holiday and they remind you, double check what you've got in your bags before you get to the airport. And there's always this list that they put out of, well, what are some of the things that were found this year by people not paying attention? And I'm always amazed at the list of things. I mean, from brass knuckles to knives to power tools, wrenches, baseball bats. I mean, it's there was a story, and there's at the Atlanta International Airport, there's like these cases to demonstrate. One of them had a chainsaw. Someone thought they could take on carry-on a chainsaw. Like, you can't take
a
chainsaw on carry-on. Like, why not? I need to check it. I'm not going to check a chainsaw. Like, yes, you can't take it on board. Crazy.
It's very true.
People are crazy. I'll save it in case you want a story, but I can tell you how much it's changed since 9/11, because I had to have something confiscated from me, but I'll save that for another story.
Ooh, save that for tomorrow.
Yeah, how about that?
There you go. All right. So, Alan, you want to once again tell people where they can find you?
Sure. If you're interested in a news talk, political talk, you can find me. I do a daily show. It is from my flagship station in Atlanta, WSB Radio. You can go to wsbradio.com/The Alan Sanders Show, or just Google The Alan Sanders Show. I drop it everywhere you can download. If you're not into that, if that's not your cup of tea, but you want to do more of the entertainment, my buddy Walt and I, we did a Movies by Minutes called The Wilder Ride, where we broke down movies of Gene Wilder. We did Young Frankenstein season 1. We did Blazing Saddles season 2. Changed it into a talk show, interviewed some really, really cool guests. And definitely worth going in, at least browsing through the catalog of our seasons 3 and 4 to check that out. We took a hiatus a couple of years ago when things were going a little different and haven't returned officially yet, but you still got all that. You got 4 years, 4 seasons worth of content to go look through.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter/X. So until tomorrow. Yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
if you're fond of sand dunes and salty air. Quaint little village.